Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life, and by Cancer Treatment Centers of America in Philadelphia.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. Some days it feels like I spend most of my time cleaning up. There is a heap of dirty clothes that need to be washed, dishes piling up in the sink. I have kids, so there's never a shortage of Legos that need to be picked up. At work, my desk is cluttered with papers that I have to throw out, and then I have to clean up my computer desktop because I can't find anything. And of course, behind the scenes, there are squads of people cleaning up after me, after all of us, making things nice for us. The garbage guys that come early in the morning, crews cleaning up our sewers, treating our wastewater, maybe a specialist removing mold from a damp basement. Cleaning up is a science, and that's what we're talking about on today's show. We'll see what cleaning up looks like at the bottom of the ocean and deep in your brain, and we'll hear why some people say returning a landscape to a pristine state is overrated. Our first story takes us to the remote desert of northwest Nevada. Almost 70,000 people gather here once a year for Burning Man. It's a giant, I guess, art festival, if you want to call it that. There are over 1,000 open bars, hundreds of giant fires, and guess how many garbage cans are provided? Zero. None. Every year, Burning Man somehow leaves the desert sparkling clean after this 9-day event is over. There's a serious culture of responsibility among the festival goers, and their diligence has made this event a model for how to clean up after a massive public gathering. To see how they do this, Andrew Stelzer got dirty in the desert.
It's the second to last day of Burning Man. The festival's signature 50-foot-high wooden man went up in flames last night, and thousands of people are packing up to go home. Riding my bike around the pop-up city, I see a handful of folks bent over scanning the desert floor and raking the dusty ground. I hop off my bike and ask Adam Schmidt what's going on. He camped here with a group of about 20 people from Seattle.
So you are standing where Camp License to Chill used to be. We served snow cones and had sort of just a general lounge space.
At Burning Man, there's always a bit of lingo that has to be decoded. Adam was part of a theme camp. Most people at Burning Man name their group and offer some sort of service or entertainment to the public.
We'd have just hundreds of people coming through. And as much as everyone tries, little bits get dropped. You end up with little bits of wrappers, bottle caps. We find actually, the biggest thing is hair. Somehow hair just gets into the playa, and that is what we spend most of our time picking up.
Did you catch that? These people are standing around in 102-degree midday heat, raking the desert floor in search of stray hairs that may have been dropped over the past week. Brandon Casey just found one.
There's a hair right there, actually.
Yeah, for sure. What color?
That one looks like it was from a blue wig.
People pay between $200 and $400 for a ticket and then spend hours of their fun time cleaning up after themselves and their neighbors. Ingrid Porter is holding a small plastic baggie with pieces of string, cigarette ash, even natural stuff like pine needles. It might sound crazy, but because of the dry air and lack of bacteria in the barren desert, nothing biodegrades out here.
I've definitely seen a lot of people who carry, bags around with them all week, not even just, toward the end, but like all week to make sure that we're, really leaving no trace.
Leaving no trace is one of the 10 official principles of Burning Man, and it's part of the cultural ethic passed on by burners, people who come back here year after year. Sarah Urban from Las Vegas is a first-time burner, but her friend Mark Cooney schooled her, so they spent part of the week cleaning up the playa. That's the scientific name for these alkali flats in Nevada's Black Rock Desert.
Just you go ahead and you pick up your crap, and if you see anybody else's, you pick that up too.
What have you found?
We found a bike pump out in the deep playa, bike lights, yes.
Random ropes. Yeah. Zip ties.
The weirdest thing that we had mooped on us, though, was somebody mooped a bra on top of our car.
That's another example of Burning Man lingo. Moop. M-O-O-P stands for matter out of place. It basically means trash. If you're mooping, that means you're picking up moop.
We don't know where it came from. We don't know who it belongs to. I'm not sure what to do with it from here, but
yeah, we'll take it.
If it doesn't come from the playa, yeah, it doesn't belong in the playa. So you have to pick it up and just move it out.
After the event is over, a crew of about 150 people, a mix of paid staff and volunteers, stick around for weeks, scouring the desert, doing line sweeps in human chains, picking up anything that was left behind. Because even campers who try hard are still going to miss some moop. Dominic Tinio, who goes by DA, works for the Burning Man organization. He's head of the Playa Restoration Team.
The little things are hard, and that's just the given. It's not like we have this event on a hardwood floor and we can just sweep up all the moop. Because if that was the case, this place would be spotless. But no, we're in the Black Rock Desert.
Out on this flat, windy expanse, only seconds after you drop something, it might be obscured by a dust storm or blow away in the wind. There's glitter, sequins, and cigarette butts, but DA says these days there's a bigger offender.
The most number one common form of moop is actually wood.
Wood shavings from art projects, slivers of firewood logs that have been thrown on the ground in a big pile.
Wood will stop my crew dead in its tracks.
A bunch of wood also means that area gets marked red on the moop map. DA invented the map back in 2006 as a way to keep a record of how clean each area was left by its inhabitants.
It's like, what is the best way for us to track this and make it visual?
The map has three colors, red, yellow, and green. Green is the best. That means the restoration crew breezed through, finding a minimum of trash. Yellow means it wasn't so easy. And red is bad. During the restoration process, the team blogs daily about how things went and colors in the map online. And back at home, festival goers eagerly wait to see what color their camp got.
We wanted it to be like you're following your favorite sports team. You know, we wanted to give the community something to cheer for.
DA says shaming isn't part of the process, but there are potential consequences. If the space where you camped shows up scarlet red on the map, your group may not get assigned a prime location next year. In 2006, Camp License to Chill was green, and this year they got placed a little bit closer to the center of the city. That's one reason Patrick Foy is pushing what looks like an old-fashioned lawnmower across their site.
Oh, I'm just driving this little rolling magnet around, picking up any loose shavings or screws. Yeah. Yep. Boom. There we go.
What is it?
Looks like a bolt. Probably from a support structure. Might have been from our camp. Might have been from a previous one.
Camp License to Chill wants an even better spot next year. And they want to do the right thing, of course. But for Burning Man, cleaning up the desert is a matter of survival. The event is held on federal land and overseen by the Bureau of Land Management. Dave Cooper used to work for the Bureau.
The standard is that they can't leave more than 1 square foot of moop per acre. And they have to meet that standard or it will jeopardize their permit for the next year.
About a month after Burning Man is over, inspectors from the Bureau of Land Management come in and randomly sample plots.
Burning Man has become a master in how to clean up a site after a large event like this.
Cooper's retired. He's now a burner himself, camping with a group called the Earth Guardians. They hold lectures and conduct nature tours. And Cooper leads a champagne moop train run every day at 11 a.m.
We drink champagne and then pick up trash, make sure that it doesn't escape and get away. Doing our part to keep Black Rock City clean.
For The Pulse, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
We're talking about cleaning up on the show today, and we wanted to hear from scientists. What's cleaning up like in your lab, on the job? And we heard from Evangelina Bellis. She is a bioengineer at Temple University, and she studies adult stem cells, which she gets from human fat.
plastic surgeons provide us with this leftover tissue from tummy tuck surgeries as our source. We've had about 30 pounds of tummy tuck tissue in which we cut away the fat from the skin to mince up for isolating our stem cells. That's the equivalent of about 16 water bottles filled with minced fat. So our cleanup involves a lot of extra skin and gooey, greasy fat residue.
That's pretty gross, but so is this next story, which comes from David Faulkner. He's at UC Berkeley. And when he was an undergrad, he worked at a lab that had 100 lizards, and it was his job to clean up the lizards' habitats.
And one time, as I was cleaning out the terrarium of this lizard, it escaped. And so then I had to chase it around the lab. And in the course of doing this, the lizard did what it usually does when it gets scared, and that is it dropped its tail off. It just fell right off the lizard. And so then I'm chasing this lizard, and its tail is just flopping around on the ground and writhing. And it was just the weirdest thing to see. It was very bizarre. I did catch the lizard, though.
Cleaning up whatever it entails, that's what we're talking about on the show. And if you think chasing lizards around a lab is a tough gig, how about getting thousands of pounds of trash out of the ocean? There's a whole department at NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, dedicated to removing debris.
Starting at the tiny scale, that can be microplastics that are in cosmetic products, but it also can be consumer debris, things like water bottles, bottle caps, cigarette lighters, and then all the way up to really big things like abandoned and derelict vessels.
That's Peter Murphy. He is the Alaska coordinator for the NOAA Marine Debris Program, and he told me about a specific kind of ocean trash.
Ghost gear.
Yep, ghost gear. That's fishing gear, lines, nets, crab pots that have been lost at sea.
So they're floating around or sitting on the ocean bottom, and they're continuing to fish for years. We call that ghost fishing. So a net that's primarily used for salmon will continue to catch salmon, but it might catch other things, marine mammals, seals, dolphins, that sort of thing, as well as seabirds. So it's going to continue to catch animals for a significant period of time.
How common is this for fishing gear to get lost in the ocean?
Most gear is lost by accident. But accidents do happen even to the best of fishers. And in terms of large marine debris events, such as hurricanes and tsunamis, those can also create a bunch of gear loss all at once, both from debris that's washed out from fishing ports, as well as gear that's already in the water that gets moved around where people can't retrieve it. Since gear is made of plastic, it lasts a long time in the ocean. Here in Puget Sound, where Seattle is located, where there's a lot of fishing effort historically, and it's a culturally important area, a partner has removed over 4,000 derelict nets just over the last several years. And many of those are from a fishery that has been closed, so it's no longer active. But those nets are continuing to be found, and they last a long time in the water.
How do you find this ghost gear?
Well, it really depends on the gear. There's nets, there's crab pots, and those are going to behave differently. So for crab pots, as an example, people use side-scan sonar. So you tow this tow fish, as they call it, behind a boat, and it gives you a clear picture of the bottom, and you can actually find these crab pots. And then you can send down divers or ROVs to go down and pick it up. With derelict fishing nets, oftentimes there's a reporting system where you have fishers that can say, hey, I lost a net here. And then there can be partners that go back out and go and retrieve that net.
Are there solutions that focus on the gear itself to avoid this problem of fishing gear floating around in the ocean?
Yes, things like better ways to identify the gear so that if it's lost, you can recover it better, things like tags, and as well as other innovations in terms of the gear design itself so that if it is lost, it's going to disable itself more rapidly. So an example of that is for crab pots. You know, if you cut the line, the pots on the bottom continue to catch crab. Studies in Alaska have shown that it can do that for up to 7 years in those waters. But if you can find ways to for the pots to disable itself with biodegradable panels, then it's not going to have that impact.
Do you ever find marine animals that have adjusted to living in, quote, captivity after being caught in ghost gear and then maybe just finding a way to live in this new restricted environment, almost like in a zoo?
We do see animals that colonize gear, so gear that's lost, specifically crab pots or lobster traps, that sort of thing, that's on the bottom and stationary. We do find that animals will colonize it, you know, just like any other stable structure. But that's really for animals that are capable of doing that. For ones that are caught on the inside, rarely are they really able to make that work just based on the restrictions of the space and not being able to get out to their food. So it's kind of a balance that we always have to look at of, you know, the removal. How much are we disturbing the habitat by removing something?
That was Peter Murphy from NOAA's Marine Debris Program. When it comes to drugs like heroin, cocaine, alcohol, we used to think that cleaning up meant to stop using and getting the drugs out of your system, a fresh start. But new addiction science tells us that that notion is largely a myth because the underlying addiction is still there long after the chemicals are gone. Doctors and scientists are gaining a better understanding about the complex ways this can play out in the brain and why it's so hard to stay clean. Alana Gordon takes it from here.
The story of Nate Robinson reads like a history text for drugs in America. In the 60s and 70s, it was a lot of alcohol and marijuana.
Back then, that was like the hippie time.
It was also the early days of meth. In the 80s, it was cocaine and then crack.
You know, it's like a euphoric feeling. Once that wears off, you want another hit. You know, you'll spend your whole paycheck that night.
Then in the 90s came heroin.
By 97, I looked like a 60-year-old man. And I was in my late 30s. And I lost all the weight. You know, I've been a slim dude all my life anyway, but now I'm done. I mean, I'm burnt.
It was at that point that Nate went into treatment for the first time. It changed his life.
I go to a detox, rehab, go to a recovery house, 14 months clean.
He was doing really well. He got a job in guest services at a hotel.
Feeling, oh my God, haven't felt this good since my early 20s.
But then,
boom, 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 boom. Go back out.
He relapsed.
Bang! You understand me? This particular day, I rode down the wrong neighborhood, put myself right in the lion's den, as you call it.
Nate saw people getting high. It was all downhill from there. He's been in and out of treatment since. But when it comes to addiction and recovery, relapse is just really common.
My name is Rosa Friedman. I have relapsed 3 times.
Lewis Brown, relapsed 7 times out of 5 years.
My name is Mary Coco Brown. I relapsed once after 12 years.
Luke Dunn. I feel like I just had one big relapse and sort of a series of smaller ones.
One Harvard researcher, John Kelly, found in reviewing lots of past studies, people may still be really susceptible to relapse for a long time after getting into recovery.
So for example, we know that to get 1 year of full sustained remission can take several years. It can take up to 4 or 5 treatments and roughly 8 years on average before people achieve that first year.
So why is it so damn hard to quit, to clear out an addiction? It's a simple question with a very complicated, nuanced answer that has a lot of moving parts. Because relapse varies by person, by experience, by triggers, trauma, and life stressors, good and bad, and the severity of the addiction to begin with. But it's a dynamic that scientists like Dr. Anna Rose Childress have been slowly cracking by cracking a lid on the brain itself.
The amygdalas are glowing and they're talking to the ventral stratum here.
Childress is a leading neurroscientist at the University of Pennsylvania's Addiction Center, where she has been trying to zero in on that moment of relapse.
This is 3 views.
To figure out how to prevent it. There's an old saying in the recovery community that the people, the places, and things need to change. But she says it goes beyond that.
One of the things that was intriguing to me is that people would sometimes come to me with accounts of, you know, I don't know what triggered me. I don't really know. I was okay, doc. 1 minute I was fine. I was sitting there minding my own business, having breakfast. And then the next thing I knew, I felt incredibly pulled. I was on a mission. I was out the door. I don't know what happened to me.
Childress says, at a closer look, the brain contains a really powerful reward system, a circuitry, that for thousands of years has been essential to our survival. It's the one that lights up and goes nuts during opportunities for sex and food.
This is the absolute priority for our brain, is to make sure that we respond to those rewards so that we stay alive and pass on our genes.
That reward system is stronger in some people than in others. There's a sort of dark irony to this, because this would have been a huge advantage during any other time in our evolutionary past.
The very brain that essentially would make us the fittest of the fit, right? That we would be the first to find the food, having sex, essentially keeping our genes going. That brain is the brain that is now at greatest disadvantage in these last eye blinks of history.
The rules of survival have changed, but drugs can put this reward system into overdrive and teach it to continue seeking out such powerful highs. But it's not just the brain's reward system. It's the brain's brakes, too. In the same way that at some point you have to stop eating all the cake, drugs weaken those brakes.
Some drugs of abuse, stimulants like cocaine and amphetamine, with chronic exposure to these, regardless of where your brakes started, actually erode your braking power. You're rubbing them out.
To get a sense of how powerful brain chemistry is, Childress did a series of MRI experiments where she flashed, for just a few milliseconds, a photo of drugs in front of someone with addiction. It was a flash that happened so fast, you wouldn't even notice it. But she saw it still triggered the reward system, lighting up that part of the brain.
And so we're good storytellers about why we did what we did as though we decided it, but some of it actually is occurring outside our awareness. So that's another piece of the picture, is that not all of our decision-making is nearly as conscious as we like to think that it is. But whatever amount of it we had that was conscious and deliberate and that was essentially good decision-making often gets eroded by this disorder in a very biological way.
It's really overbearing.
Well, it's essentially taking away some of what we'd like to think of as our essence, right? And so part of recovery is really trying to get back your decision-making ability, because that really is very close to who you are.
This is why for many in the addiction community, the use and advancement of medication-assisted therapy, like methadone and buprenorphine, which in different ways blocks or fills those reward systems for drugs, is so critical. What's less known, though, is how the addicted brain and those systems change and evolve over time in recovery. That work is much harder to do and is just beginning. So, does all this mean that relapse is inevitable?
People conclude it's a moral failing, that recovery is not possible.
That's not true, not even close, says Dr. Rose Julius.
We don't come to any of those conclusions with any other chronic condition. It does not mean that you have to live with this sort of negative albatross around you forever. It just means that you have a condition that you need to properly manage.
Rose is head of addiction services for Philadelphia's big Medicaid program. And she says the key to all of this is managing it like you would any other chronic disease, through ongoing supports and treatment long term. And part of that process is also amplifying the message that recovery is possible. She sees this with patients all the time. It's why just a few weeks ago, thousands took to the streets in Philadelphia in support of each other and their successes, large and small, during a massive recovery celebration.
I need to be down here. I need to be a part of this. I need to see that I can actually do this, then that if other people can do it, why can't I do it?
So our son is sober 5 years.
And we're here supporting him.
It's been such a struggle as a whole family unit. Sobriety is amazing.
It brings me strength, getting through it.
You always think that you're alone when you're out there, but here, a lot of these people got the same stuff. Yeah, I wish I'd known them before.
There's nothing wrong with starting over and opening up, you know, and telling people what you need. You need help. You can't do it alone.
I got 24 hours, but I feel hope.
Alana Gordon reported the story. This is The Pulse. We're talking about the science of cleaning up. To avoid contamination or the spread of disease, medical providers have to have specialized companies to haul away their waste. Everything from used needles to soiled bandages or discarded paper gowns. In the political fight over abortion, this has become a pressure point.
The cheerleaders of death! Witness the cheerleaders of death!
Abortion opponents are pushing waste management companies to stop doing business with clinics that provide abortions. Reporter Kathy Lohr has been looking into this, and she joins me now from Atlanta to talk more. And Kathy, there's a large medical waste management company called Stericycle, which has quit doing business with hundreds of clinics that provide abortions. How did that come about?
Well, the group behind this effort is called Created Equal. It's an anti-abortion group that's headquartered in Columbus, Ohio. And their director's name is Mark Harrington. He says without this service, he believes that many clinics would go out of business. So Harrington called his campaign Project Weak Link, and here he is talking about it on his weekly podcast.
Any enabler that provides services to an abortionist is a weak link. It just so happens some are weaker than others, and if you take them out, in other words, if you remove them as a provider of services, so to speak, then you can possibly shut down the abortion clinic.
Stericycle is one of the largest medical waste providers in the country, so that's one reason why this is so important. And Harrington's group targeted that company's CEO, Charles Aludo.
What did they do? How did they target him?
Well, they picketed his Chicago neighborhood. They sent postcards to his neighbors with these gruesome pictures of what they said was an aborted fetus. And they basically made the company's involvement with abortion a big public relations issue. In fact, so much so that the CEO filed suit against the group Created Equal to get members to stop targeting him. But a court in Illinois decided that the actions of Created Equal were indeed free speech and protected under the First Amendment.
So did the pressure against Stericycle and against the CEO, did it continue?
It did. The company eventually disclosed in court papers recently that it had stopped doing business with some 400 clinics, including many Planned Parenthood centers. Here's Mark Harrington from Created Equal talking about that success.
We're getting reports around the country that they are having difficulty finding waste providers. And so we're going to continue our campaign, and we are going to target other waste providers across the country one by one until each one of them refuses to be involved in the abortion industry.
So, Kathy, what does Planned Parenthood say about all of this?
Planned Parenthood didn't want to talk about it. They declined to comment on this story, although they did not deny that Stericycle had stopped working with some of their clinics. And Stericycle, based in Illinois, did not respond to our calls for comment on this story.
But we do know this is happening, right?
Yes, indeed. The National Abortion Federation, known as NAF, represents hundreds of independent clinics across the country. And that group is closely monitoring this campaign. President and CEO Vicky Saporta says that this is a really tough issue.
There are very few companies that do what Stericycle does. And when companies like Stericycle give in to the harassment of anti-choice proponents, it puts an unfair burden on abortion providers. And so the National Abortion Federation has been working with our members for many years to find alternative vendors so that clinics can stay open to provide care.
Again, that was Vicky Saporta of the National Abortion Federation. Now, she says clinics have had problems with vendors for years because of a pressure that protesters have put on different companies. So simple tasks like finding a plumber or a painter or even a company to pour concrete have become more difficult if you're an abortion provider. In fact, in one case, a Planned Parenthood clinic in Texas was held up in its construction process for weeks.
If these clinics don't have providers to haul off their waste, can they still operate?
They can't. Clinics have to have a qualified medical waste provider. So Planned Parenthood and the National Abortion Federation are working on a solution. And they say they realize that activists are watching. There are dozens of videos online that were taken by anti-abortion activists, and they show Stericycle trucks picking up waste at the clinics, and you see the company's bright green logo on the side of the trucks. Now that Stericycle is out of the picture, in some cases there have been unmarked white trucks picking up medical waste, and that's in part at least to prevent activists from easily identifying the vendors.
Kathy, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Kathy Lohr is a reporter in Atlanta.
Cancer Treatment Centers of America supports WHYY. If you or someone you love has been diagnosed with breast cancer, the Breast Cancer Center at CTCA may be able to help. It's comprehensive cancer care with advanced technology, targeted treatments, access to clinical trials, and a dedicated team of specialists, all together in one center. You can learn more at cancercenter.com/Philadelphia. Cancer Treatment Centers of America. Appointments available now.
Among ecologists, there is a fierce debate over what to do with land that's been altered by us, humans. That controversy is playing out on the site of the former Pruitt-Igoe housing complex in St. Louis. In the 50s and 60s, poverty, segregation, and poor maintenance led to horrendous living conditions there. And in the 1970s, the building started to come down.
Today is demolition day at Pruitt-Igoe. Here in the late afternoon, with weather moving in from the west and helicopters hovering above, Door Wrecking Company looks closely.
It's been four decades since this site was abandoned, so what can you do with it? Leave it be? Clean it up? Boyce Uphold took a tour.
It's like a paradise in the middle of St. Louis. Cottonwoods shimmer in the breeze. Between the trees, I can see wildflower meadows.
This is a nice time to come because it's greened up, so you can't see all the junk out here.
Charlie Nylon is a biologist at the University of Missouri at Columbia, and that junk he's talking about is the rubble of the Pruitt-Igoe housing projects. Brick and asphalt are mixed into the soil of this forest, which is one of the largest green spaces in the city. It's become a haven for wildlife.
And, you know, there are hawks out here and owls at night.
There are other species, too, wildlife that purists would consider to be invaders. There's lots of bush honeysuckle, a plant native to Asia. That invasive has been ravaging the city for decades. Most St. Louisans will walk right by these woods and think it's just a giant patch of weeds. Just trash. I came here at the suggestion of Emma Maris, a science writer.
I'm not really sure what I am these days. I am an environmental writer and author.
She says these kinds of places are important. This is where future generations will develop a love for nature and wildness. There's less and less pristine nature, and for most of us it is very far away. So Emma has become one of the most vocal proponents of a new idea. There is a new normal, and we need to give these places a new name. Let's call them novel ecosystems.
It gives us this way to notice these spaces that we have sort of been trained not to notice, right? And that then, if somebody came up with a proposal to pave over one of these systems, we would have a way to say, no, okay, maybe it's not Yellowstone, maybe it's not pristine, but there's a lot to value here, and we're going to fight that. We're going to fight that destruction.
This is not always a popular position. Emma and other scientists have been called defeatists. These spats can get personal. People have even accused her of hating the real wilderness.
I mean, I've actually started taking pictures of myself standing next to various like designated wilderness signs. At some point, I'm going to publish like a slideshow of Emma Maris actually going to the wilderness to prove that I have actually been to the wilderness.
The thing is, traditionalists think we should consider places like this trash. If we call these degraded ecosystems, that might inspire someone to take action and clean things up. But call it a novel ecosystem, and there are players who might use this as an excuse. Think of industrialists or developers who might pollute and then say, hey, we've made a new novel ecosystem.
These players say, well, we're sorry, but the leading scientists tell us that the whole world is in a new ecological world order. This is the new normal. So polluting industries are getting a get-out-of-jail-free card.
James Aronson is a conservation scientist at the Missouri Botanical Garden. He was actually a co-author on the first paper to use the phrase novel ecosystems. But since then, he's decided that term was a problem. To understand the controversy, you have to know some basics about ecological restoration. When scientists are setting out to restore a landscape, they'll choose a reference ecosystem as a target, a baseline. We knew it looked like this in the past, and we're trying to get back there. But maybe we shouldn't spend so much time winding back the clock.
The restoration costs money,
and conservation and restoration dollars are always scarce, and in my opinion, they always will be.
That's Richard Hobbs, an ecologist at the University of Western Australia. But he's not just an ecologist. Like James, he's a restoration ecologist. Rather than just observe ecosystems, they tend to, you know, restore them.
We need to be very careful about prioritizing what we're doing, making sure that we back winners and don't do stuff that isn't going to result in good outcomes in the end.
Many in the restoration ecology community see Richard as something of a radical.
So, you know, I'm called Mr. Noble Ecosystems these days because my name's been on the papers that have promulgated this.
Radical or traditional, restoration ecology is always political. It requires us to make choices. Richard says we need to confront the fact that whatever we choose, we are revealing our values. In St. Louis, my tour with biologist Charlie Nylon continues. We leave the old housing project site and head to some other places where man has altered the landscape, but where wildlife still thrives. We see doves and turkey. Charlie says he's seen coyote tracks, even bald eagles. These are important spaces.
Whatever you want to call them, they're here. They're an important part of maintaining biodiversity in cities, and so you had to be intentional and thoughtful about how you manage it.
But no one is managing the old Pruitt-Igoe housing site as a wilderness. It's become one through neglect. And soon that might change. Last year, a developer bought the land. He said it will be the crown jewel in a massive commercial project that will include a hotel, a hospital, stores, and offices. For a lot of people, this is cleaning up the site. They don't want an empty, unkept lot down the street from their homes. For others, though, it's a missed opportunity.
That was Boyce Uphold reporting from St. Louis. It usually takes time for nature to erase our footsteps, slowly reclaiming spaces once occupied by buildings or roads. But sometimes nature takes over in an abrupt or violent way. When Hurricane Irma hit in September, it left a path of death and destruction that will take years to clean up. Rescue and evacuation efforts always focus on people first, but when it's your job to care for animals, you have to make sure they are okay too. I'm talking about a number of exotic animals that hold a special place in many people's hearts, the residents of the Naples Zoo. Carrie Barber reports.
Hurricane Irma ripped through the Naples Zoo about a week before I visited in September. Rebuilding was in full force. As zoos go, this one is pretty small. You can visit just about all the animals in a one-mile stroll. But what it lacks in size, it makes up for in tropical beauty. The zoo's always been known for its graceful tree cover almost as much as its animals, until Irma struck. The storm hit land with wind speeds of more than 100 miles an hour, ripping tall palms up by their roots. Irma blew away the macaw cages and left walking paths under 2 feet of water. Two animals died. They were antelopes called greater kudu. They couldn't take the stress of the storm, but all 161 of the other animals did okay. Zoo President Jack Mulvena.
You know, we kept the carnivores here in hurricane-proof buildings. The tigers, the leopards, the cheetahs, the bears, the hyena.
This is Southwest Florida, after all, prime hurricane territory. So the zoo has every kind of emergency plan in place. The staff had been prepping for weeks before, when Irma was just a whisper, but the storm grew. The big concern was the storm surge, a rush of water coming behind the hurricane. They'd carefully crated up the smaller animals and placed them in hurricane-proof shelters, but zoo staffers worried that a wall of water would overtake and drown the animals.
Given the fact that the storm surge continued to increase, and at one point at the end they were saying it could possibly be 10 to 15 feet, that covers most of our holding buildings. So we made a decision, rightfully so, on Saturday morning to evacuate 89 of our crated animals.
So where do you go with 89 zoo animals? You take them to Nancy Jane Tetzloff Barron's house. Her home is inland and a much safer bet. Tetzloff's late husband was known as Jungle Larry. She was Safari Jane. Together they founded the collection of animals that now makes up the Naples Zoo. Director of Animal Programs Liz Harmon oversaw the evacuation to the Tetzloff home.
We actually had a system. We had the primates on one side of the garage, and we had the carnivores on the other side of the garage. We had the tortoises kind of down the middle, and then inside the house we had some of the birds. They were actually very calm. It was kind of eerie how close quarters they were and smelling their predators and the people, animals they hadn't smelled before, and they were actually all very calm, very very polite when we would hand them food, and so everybody worked out really well.
Wow, what do you attribute that to?
I guess it's sort of like people, you know, when a storm's coming, how everybody is really nice to each other that they're not always nice to before. I kind of think it affects animals maybe the same way.
Just a few days after the storm, the staff had cleared enough space to get all the animals back in their enclosures. And by the end of that first week, the keepers say the animals were starting to feel comfortable again, like these Siamang gibbons. They're dark-haired primates with concerned faces and large pouches at their throats that give them serious vocal power. Meanwhile, staffers turn to the enormous task of restoring the zoo's landscape. Director of Gardens and Grounds, Danielle Green.
Our tree cover here is probably, you know, 25% gone. We've lost some specimens. We had a royal palm that was nearly 100 years old, and the head snapped off, and it took us a few days to find it.
As her team digs into the overwhelming job of clearing the downed trees and repairing structures, they're taking their cues from the animals.
These guys are amazing. They seem to have gotten back to normal quicker than I would have ever imagined. Uno, our Florida panther, was out in his habitat yesterday after we were able to get debris and mend some fences. And it seemed to me that this was the first day of normalcy for a lot of us to see him resting in his normal spot, looking calm. It makes us feel calm that we're getting close. Every day we're getting closer.
Carrie Barber reported the story. We've been talking about cleaning up, and we asked scientists to tell us what cleaning up is like on their job. Here is a story we got from Mike Kismarczyk from the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia. He was showing a turkey vulture to a classroom full of kids.
And the vulture decided to start flapping her wings just for a second, which scared the kids, so they jumped up, which scared the turkey vulture, so she did what's called baiting, which is basically flying around my head while I'm holding on to her jesses, which are attached to her ankles. And then she proceeded to vomit all over the classroom. Keep in mind what vultures eat, carrion, dead stuff, and they have pretty strong stomach acid, so it was not a pleasant smell. It took a lot of disinfectant and paper towels to clean it all up and about 2 cans of Lysol to get most of the smell gone, although from what I understood, the next morning the teacher came in and there was still a bit of a smell there.
I'm sure that was the last show and tell that these kids ever had in that classroom. When you go to a seafood restaurant and you splurge on some oysters, chances are the shells end up in the trash afterwards. But some restaurants try to compost them, and others go a step further. They put those shells to work to help clean up the ocean. Irina Zhurov reports.
About 120 miles east of Washington, D.C., Delaware's coast is dotted with quaint beach towns and miles of pretty shoreline. In the southern part of the state, a thin strip of land separates the ocean from the bays that have pushed into the mainland. I'm driving on this tenuous thread of land with Dave Rotondo.
I am the oyster picker-upper, oyster shell picker-upper.
Is that an official title?
Yeah, right. That's what my shirt says.
To our right spreads the Atlantic Ocean. To our left, Rehoboth Bay. It's raining and miserably cold. When he pulls up behind a restaurant in touristy Rehoboth Beach, he quickly heads to a line of trash bins set against a fence.
This is like the mailman, you know? Rain or sleet or snow, regardless, right? We gotta do our job.
The containers are filled with oyster shells, and they're kind of smelly. He loads the bins into his truck and replaces them with clean barrels. In the summer, Dave makes his trip twice a week to area restaurants, picking up hundreds of pounds of shells. He takes his cargo to a small clearing in a state park and dumps the shells atop a pile already more than 5 feet high. There are 3 such piles. They're evidence of our love for oysters.
If you look at the piles and you think, you know, it used to be a buck a shuck was a good thing.
That's Bob Collins, the program manager for a conservation group called the Delaware Center for the Inland Bays.
If you looked at here a buck a shuck, you get an idea of what the oyster business at the beach here, how much money it's worth.
In the U.S., we eat about 60 million pounds of oyster meat per year. Just imagine how many shells that is. along coastlines from the Chesapeake Bay to the Gulf Coast. Efforts have popped up to keep all these shells out of landfills. The center started one a few years ago. A bunch of volunteers from a local restaurant group are packing the shells from one of the piles into netted bags. The bags will eventually be placed back in the water. There, they'll protect shorelines from storms and function as reefs.
Oysters are what was known as a keystone species.
That means they play an outsized role in the health and makeup of the ecosystem.
It's documented in the inland bays that there's 49 other beneficial species that are attracted to oyster reefs.
The shells will serve as habitat for the sea life, much like a natural oyster reef, though the stacked bags will give the reef a different look underwater. The sea life the reef supports will filter and clean the water.
Oysters, clams, mussels, they all filter. They all like other shell. That's really important for them to grow. And what we're doing is we're taking a waste product that would otherwise end up in a landfill, repurposing into a product that's going to help improve our water quality.
A front loader dumps a load of shells onto a table with holes, like a whack-a-mole machine, but with netted bags under the holes.
All right, here we go.
Chris Medford, one of the volunteers, pushes the shells into the holes. Then,
tie it up.
Seals the bags. Chris is director of operations for restaurant group Sodell Concepts, which operates several raw bars in the area. He's also an oyster eater. His favorite oyster?
Island Creeks. They're just good brine. Nice saltiness to them.
Island Creeks come from Rhode Island and Massachusetts.
I don't need lemon or cocktail sauce or anything. They're salty. That's fine.
In over a decade at his job, he's begun to wonder where all those shells he carries out in buckets go. For the past few years, they've been going to this very yard. Chris likes the idea of dumping the shells back in the water to clean it for future harvest, perhaps.
We don't have a lot of Delaware oysters right now, so hopefully these will be my favorite in a couple years.
For the first time in decades, Delaware has opened about 350 acres of its bays to people interested in starting commercial oyster beds there. Leases are still pending, but maybe soon, the shucked shells will help bring local oysters to the table.
That was Irina Zhurov reporting. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alana Gordon, Irina Zhurov, and Alan Yu. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Our associate producers are Paige Flager and Alex Stern. Tanya English is our managing editor, and Megan Pinto, our executive producer. Today, we went to the big Burning Man Festival in Nevada and learned a new word for trash, moop, matter out of place.
My name is Uncle Awesome. I'm here to keep the dream alive. I'm holding a beer, I'm holding a bag, and I'm dragging a rake behind me because moop, there it is. Moop, there it is.
Don't ever miss a moment of The Pulse. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral Health Reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to supporting innovative approaches in integrated health care.
The Haran Lung Center at Penn Medicine supports WHYY. Chronic breathing problems can have a devastating effect on a person's quality of life. The Haran Lung Center at Penn Medicine specializes in treating patients with COPD, cystic fibrosis, chronic lung infections, and other advanced lung diseases. Information on the Haran Lung Center is available at pennmedicine.org/breatheeasier or 800-789-PENN. Penn Medicine, because your life, every breath of it, is worth Penn Medicine. Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.